Welcome to another edition of the TDN Writers Room podcast. My name is Bill Finley. I'm a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News, also the co-host of the Down the Stretch radio show every Saturday morning on Sirius XM Radio.
How y'all doing? I'm Randy Moss on hiatus with NBC Sports, licking my wounds right now from going 0-2 in fantasy football this past week. There's not much you can do when the guy you're playing scores 161 points, but anyway.
Well, I didn't play fantasy football, so I'm undefeated. Zoe Cadman here with XB TV and First Racing.
Well, guys, let's start off looking at what happened over the weekend in California. Lots of developments, some good, not so good. And the Desi Arnaz, the story there coming in was not so much the horses who were running, but more of the same that we keep seeing. They had a four horse field. Three of the four were trained by Bob Baffert, and then he actually entered a fourth horse, so which was scratched. So it would have been four or five. Ironically, Baffert didn't win. Tim Yakteen did, winning with Practical Dream. But you know, Zoe, share your thoughts about the race, but also share your thoughts about, you know, is this good for racing to keep having the same situation where Baffert is that dominant?
I mean, the question we need to ask is it Bob's fault that everyone wants to send him the best two-year-old and nobody wants to run against him? It's kind of a catch-22, and we've been talking about it for years. We're going to talk about Mike Rapoli a little bit later on, but we need an influx of real dirt horses to run on the dirt against Bob. Now, a lot of people in Southern California are buying turf horses. They don't want to compete with the best of Bob's, and most of the time, they can't. So kudos to trainer Tim Yakteen. Him and Bob are good friends, that he put Practical Dream in there when a lot of people might be like, yeah, screw that. I'm not going to even bother. So Practical Dream was much the best in there and outrun them all. But this is a problem that we are continually facing in Southern California, getting dirt races to go, especially maiden races. And then once you broke the maiden, you've got to go into a stake. And then you're still facing more of the same. It's a big problem.
Yeah, first the race, and then I'll weigh in a little bit on that. Practical Dream, Antonio Freisu aboard. Tactically, Freisu rode a really good race because Baffert's 1-2 favorite in their Silent Law. Very speedy, and in their most recent race, Practical Dream had set back a little bit and let Silent Law control the pace and couldn't run her down. This past weekend, Practical Dream was drawn inside of Silent Law, and so Freisu just took it to Silent Law right from the start. They went head and head all the way around. Didn't finish very fast. The figure wasn't very good, like I think a 73 buyer speed figure. So the jury's still out on how good these horses are going to be going forward in the whole Kentucky Oaks scheme of things. But a nice stakes win for Practical Dream. And also a kind of a feel-good thing. The owners, Pierre and Leslie Amestoy from New Mexico, and their partner, Roger Beasley from Austin, Texas, have had so much heartbreak and so much bad luck in this sport, primarily a year ago with Practical Move. If you remember, that's the horse that really catapulted the Amestoys into national prominence when he won the Santa Anita Derby, went on to Kentucky. I was there talking to him the morning of the scratch of Practical Move from the Kentucky Derby due to some issues. They were bringing him back later in the year after a successful comeback race to run in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile, and he had an apparent cardiac episode and died on the track at Santa Anita the week of the Breeders' Cup. I mean, how much more heartbreak can you get than that? Their very best thoroughbred horse. And now they've stuck it out. They've got Practical Dream. They've got Mackenzie Street, who we'll talk about in just a second. Another 3-year-old colt or 2-year-old colt who is stakes level. So it's a nice story to see the Amistoys not only stick it out and endure the ups and downs in the sport, but bounce back with some nice horses this year as well. As far as the Baffert thing goes, look, I've been a proponent of doing something to try to lessen the dominance of the so-called super trainers in the sport. Okay. I remember, and Zoe remembers, when we first came around, you know, there were stall limits at a racetrack. Maybe 40 horses would be the max that a trainer would be allowed to train. This is not necessarily Baffert I'm talking about here, but some of the super trainers out there, especially on the East Coast, might have 200, 250, and they control everything, right? I don't know why we can't have a scenario where, even if stall space is not controlled, where a racetrack can say, okay, a particular trainer, we will allow you to run 60 different individual horses during our meet. That's the cap. No more than that. And then maybe you see some of these horses get spread around to other horsemen, and suddenly the field sizes get a little bit bigger because there's more horses available to run against each other. You know, that might be a potential solution. I don't think that necessarily applies to Bob Baffert, because I don't think he's sitting there with 250 or 300 horses. Zoe, I think you get the nail right on the head. You know, this is by all stats, you know, Bob is the most successful trainer in the history of horse racing. And people want him to train their horses, especially two-year-olds and potential Kentucky Derby and Kentucky Oaks type horses. You can't blame owners for wanting Bob to train their horses, and you can't blame other trainers for not wanting to run against the $800,000, $700,000, $600,000 horses trained to the minute by Bob Baffert in these two-year-old races. I don't know what you can do about that, but the so-called super trainer syndrome, there probably is something you can do about it. It might not be politically correct, but it might be something that horse racing needs to look at.
So on the next day at Santa Anita, at Del Mar, of course, there was the Bob Hope Stakes, which is the male equivalent of the Desi Arnaz. Quick question. Shouldn't the Desi Arnaz be called the Lucille Ball? Let's see if we can get that worked on. Okay? Oh,
Lucy was at the track occasionally, but it was Desi that dragged her to the track. It was Desi that bought a house next to Del Mar. Right. You know, he was the big horse racing guy.
All right. So anyways, the next day they have the Bob Hope Stakes. Baffert only had 2 of 5 starters in there. The winner for Michael McCarthy was a horse by the name of Bullard. Ran very well, but boy, if a horse ever got a better pace setup than this one, they were flying up front, 21.63, 43.93. This horse just blew by them in the stretch. I think he blew by a lot of tired horses. Visually impressive, but when you take a look at the pace figures and how the race shaped up, got to say, did he just benefit from a perfect trip, Zoe?
I mean, that definitely did help him. He's a big, burly horse who does his best running late. But I think he's a good horse. Is he the best horse in Mike McCarthy's barn? I'm not sure he is. We'll get to the maiden winner in just a moment. But he was much the best in there. Mackenzie Street's a good horse for the Amistoys. And Randy already mentioned him. He got a brutal ride. And I love Kazushi Kimura. He's a very good rider. I'm not really sure what he was thinking. He kind of sent him up to the lead. They went 43-4. I mean, come on. There's no way you can hold on going that quick. He hasn't got a really good ride in his last couple of races. I believe Mackenzie Street's a lot better than we've seen in his last 2 races. But Bullard's a good horse, and he is beautiful. $675,000 they paid for him at Keeneland September, and he looks every bit of it.
He's got a solid pedigree. He's by Gunrunner. When you watched his maiden win September the 1st at Del Mar, when he ran down Kalia Bay, trained by Baffert, they're going around the turn there, and all of a sudden, whoa, you see this big dynamic move right through the middle of the pack. Who is that? And it turned out to be Bullard. And he was green coming down the stretch. He was slow changing leads and all that, but he still, I don't know if he ever did change leads that day. But he ran down Kalia Bay anyway and indicated that he was going to be a force to be reckoned with. So Bob Baffert runs horses, heavy favorites. And well, I actually Bullard was the favorite, but two races for 2 year olds, two stakes races, Baffert wins neither one of them. If you just look at graded stakes races on dirt for 2 year olds in Southern California, going into the Bob Hope, Baffert had won 10 in a row.
Wow.
Dating all the way back to the Bob Hope of last year, and just before that, the American Pharoah of 2023. So this broke a streak here for Baffert when Bullard ran past the first-time starter, Matiquette Road. Zoe mentioned it might not be the best two-year-old in Mike McCarthy's barn. Earlier on the card, a very strong maiden win for a son of Kirtland named Journalism, who has been crying for more distance, and he finally got two turns in his, I say finally, it was his second lifetime start, but he was very eye-catching, great pedigree on the dam side as well. And Zoe, I think this could really be a stakes horse in Southern California coming up.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to be Michael McCarthy right now. He's got Sandy Bottom as well, the filly. His two-year-olds are late developing, and I think he's designed it that way. But he looked really good. And like you said, he's got the pedigree to match. Journalism's a real deal. And a great name. What a great name that is.
The dam is Mopetism. You may remember him.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Paul Redham, Paul and Zilla Redham campaigned Mopetism, trained by Doug O'Neill. She won $800,000+. She ran in 14 grade one races, including the Kentucky Oaks and the Breeders' Cup Distaff twice. So in her 26 race career, she ran against some pretty tough ones. So Mopetism is her first foal to actually second foal to race, I believe. No, first foal to race, And it's turned out to be a good one, I think.
So there's everything in the discussion in California racing, unfortunately, doesn't always just talk about the races on the track. Zoe, Randy, you guys know it well. Zoe probably more than anyone else because you live out there. It's a tough time for California racing, for some of the reasons we've already talked about. Small fields, purses are nowhere near what they are in places like Kentucky. So Mike Rapoli is someone who came out this week and said, you know what, I'm going to support California horse racing. I'm sending horses there. And, you know, if he sends 10 horses there, it's not going to make that huge difference. But it is good to see somebody say that California needs to be strong for the racing industry to be strong. Then the other subject that keeps coming up is, are they ever going to get HHR machines? I was always told that sort of thing is not on the table because the lobby of the Indian casinos, but you can always wish for that. Zoe, what do you make of all that?
I mean, it's good that Rapoli's sending some horses. I mean, he's had a couple of horses here for the last few years in Southern California, but looks like he's sending some better stock out here, which is good. And, you know, to quote him, you can't have, a national racing without California. I'm not sure that people realize what a massive industry it is out here in Southern California. And we're running on fumes right now. It will be nice for some other entities to send some horses out here. But, I mean, I understand that it's expensive. It's expensive to live. It's expensive to train. And we definitely need some purse funding. We are like the only place in the country that is pretty much self-sufficient as far as the purse payment. And we're in a deficit right now anyway. So we are screaming out to basically get in bed with the tribes. I mean, we've got a bunch of casinos. I don't know if they're ever going to make that happen. Perhaps this should have happened 20 years ago. But we're surrounded by casinos. You've got Yamava, you've got Morongo just down the road. If we can just try and form some kind of symbiotic friendship with them, maybe we have a chance, but we definitely need it.
And of course, the Native American casinos they proliferated in California. And yeah, with the casinos come the campaign contributions to politicians. And therefore, so far, any motion whatsoever to add HHR machines or slot machines to racetracks is a non-starter. It's just a non-starter. I mean, politicians have even told racing authorities in Southern California, don't even mention it. Don't even bring it up. You're wasting your time. It's not going to happen. And so what's now a situation in thoroughbred racing is that It's in the discussion stage with Mike Rapole and Tom Ryan of SF Racing, you know, who have come out and said that the racing industry as a whole, including Kentucky, they've singled out Kentucky, needs to do something to help Southern California racing. Because without California, Kentucky racing takes a hit. Kentucky breeding takes a hit. That's how important California is to thoroughbred racing. And you have this internal power struggle going on right now in the sport, because you've got the people in Kentucky, for example, Damon Thayer, a friend of mine who's one of the big political power brokers in Kentucky with a horse racing background. Damon Thayer has been front and center in the resurrection of Kentucky horse racing through expanded gaming over the last 10 or 20 years. And he said, look, we've done it in Kentucky. We worked hard to do it in Kentucky. We have gotten Kentucky to where it is right now. It's not our fault that California racing is struggling so badly. Why should Kentucky be the one singled out to help support Southern California? They should be able to handle that on their own like we did. So I can see both sides. And it's a really, really important topic to try to get solved. But something's got to happen, because California racing right now is not in a good place.
And to quote a friend of mine who will go nameless, and I was, you know, giving the same pitch about Kentucky and you should help us out. They're like, where was California when Kentucky was like dying? You know, where were these other states coming in to help us? Like, we did it on our own. Like, no, you're not having any of our money. Screw you. You didn't help us when we were running for 25,000 maiden special weights. Like, Kentucky was dying, the whole industry. And I guess nobody reached out. So you're right.
And Mike Rapole, to his credit, I mean, he's a New York guy through and through, but he's carrying the ball now for Kentucky horse racing for the good of the industry. And we've talked about this. I've brought it up before on the podcast. Rapole mentioned the NFL as a example of how disparate elements can pull together for the good of the whole. I've mentioned it. You go all the way back to the mid-1930s when the NFL was just a very minor league operation. You had college football dominant. You had horse racing dominant. You had boxing dominant. I mean, NFL teams, some of them were playing in high school football stadiums. It was like a sort of a sideshow kind of deal. The New York Giants, Chicago Bears, Green Bay Packers were dominant. Everybody else was losing money. And they came together and said, for the good of the NFL, we will institute a draft so that the have-nots can have access to the same sort of college players that we've been paying out of college for the good of the sport as a whole. It's going to hurt us. It's going to hurt the New York Giants. It's going to hurt the Chicago Bears. It's going to hurt the Green Bay Packers. But all the other teams in the NFL can be lifted up, because if we don't do that, we may be a dominant team in the NFL, but there won't be an NFL anymore to be a dominant team in. And that's the situation right now, I think, with California horse racing. I mean,
that, of course, is why we also will be talking ad nauseum, and probably we'll be talking the same subject 10 years from now. Racing needs a commissioner. It's not going to happen. We all know that. But don't tell that to Mike Rapole, who was working very hard to make some changes. Not only did he send horses to California, he's bringing Fierceness back to run at four. I think he deserves a tremendous amount of credit for that. He is walking the walk. But I bet you today he had a real smile on his face when the press release from the Jockey Club came out saying that Stuart Janney was resigning. And Rapole has been a serious thorn in the side of the Jockey Club. I think Stuart Janney did a perfectly good job. I don't really agree with Mike on this stuff. And I have been told he was not pushed out. He's 77 years old, and it was just time. So, but Mike Rapole, maybe in a roundabout way, got his wish. Stuart Janney's no longer chairman of the Jockey Club. Everett Dobson will be taking over.
And Everett's a fabulous guy. He really, really is. And of course, Stuart Janney will be there till August 25, and then Everett Dobson will take over. I wonder what this means to his – obviously, Stuart Janney still had ownership of horses, and Everett Dobson has his Cheyenne stables. Does he have to step back a little bit? What do you think? Or not?
I don't think so, because Janney was always running horses.
Yeah.
So it would be the difference.
But it's good that you need a commissioner with a piece of the pie, someone who, you know, it affects, so to speak.
And Rapoli has been extremely critical of Stuart Janney and the Jockey Club as being emblematic of the good old boys that for decades have run the sport. And in Rapoli's words, we'll meet at the round table every year at Saratoga and slap each other on the back and light up cigars, take a sip of bourbon, look what we talked about, and then leave, and then nothing happens, you know. And it's been in the works for Stuart Janney to step down now for quite a while. They gave him the Eclipse Award of Merit last year at the Eclipse Awards for all the achievements that he's, you know, that he's accomplished in thoroughbred racing. It'll be interesting to see how Rapoli and Everett Dobson work together. Rapoli has said that he's been in contact with the Jockey Club about some of these initiatives that he's talking about right now. So that would be the best case scenario for the sport, to get someone like Mike Rapoli, as aggressive as he is, out there, you know, beating the drum and working hand in hand with an organization as powerful within the industry as the Jockey Club.
We want to remind you that the TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by Keeneland. And what a record-breaking year it was for Keeneland. In September, they held the highest grossing auction in Keeneland history. The fall meet saw record purses and all sources wagering. They launched a new sales event at the Breeders' Cup in the championship sale. And if that's not enough, the November sale saw a vibrant global market and a new record median. And now we're on to January. The three-day January sale will be held from January the 13th to the 15th. Make plans to attend. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
At Keeneland, a horse will always be measured in hands. Hands that see, that sense, that speak. Hands that hold our sport to a higher standard. Not for our sake, but for theirs. For the love of the horse, for generations to come.
Fastest Horse of the Week this week is brought to you by Nashville, one of the fast sires at Windstar Farm. Look, we know he's a fast horse. He's got the track record at Keeneland for 6 furlongs. But Nashville is also off to a fast start at stud. He had a very strong Keeneland November sale. His weanling sold for $230,000, $190,000, $140,000, and so on. That $230,000 filly was a half-sister to Iroquois Stakes winner Jonathan's Way, who we just saw compete in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. Nashville's weanlings averaged 4.5 times their stud fee, the second highest ROI among all freshman sires with two or more weanlings that sold in 2024. You get all that, and Nashville is standing for only $15,000 at Windstar Farm. Now, the fastest horse of the week is a horse that we'll talk about a little more later in the podcast. No Balls, who won the Kennedy Road at Woodbine on synthetic with the buyer speed figure of 100. So he thinks he's got the best name, the gelding, of any active racehorse right now. We had a lot of fun with the name when No Balls won the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint last year on the telecast, especially since the telecast for that particular race was on Peacock and not NBC. We could just go balls to the wall and talk about No Balls being a gelding and how fun that name was. But No Balls, back. He's back as the fastest horse of the week.
Welcome in now the guest of the week, who is Mark Cornett. He, along with his brother Clint, operates C2 Racing. And they're going to have an exciting day Friday at Gulfstream because their big star, White Iberio, is back in the entries after running the fifth in the Met Mile. Mark, bring us up to speed on him. Two-part question. How is he doing? And you have any explanation why his form was a little off before you put him on the sidelines?
Well, he's doing great. You know, we did have to back off of him. You know, we sent over to Saudi. We ran over there. And you know, I don't have a lot of experience dealing with shipping horses over there. And I think he got knocked out a little more than we thought he did with a trip, to be honest. So we brought him back in the Met Mile. He just ran around there so-so. Pulled his blood after that race. And it really wasn't like we wanted to see. So that's when I talked to Safi, and I decided at that point to switch him over to Safi. And we turned him out there at Saratoga just to give him a fresh. And he's never had any time off whatsoever since his two-year-old year, since we bought him in September of his two-year-old year. So we thought the timing is right to do that. He really enjoyed that. Came back at Saratoga, put in a few foundation building works over there, and then we got him down here to Gulfstream, and he's really been working back good. He looks great mentally. He's just fantastic. He's on his game. So we're looking for a nice comeback race here for him to get us started.
And of course, Juan Barrio famously won the Breeders' Cup Classic in 2023. You mentioned Safi. You guys and Safi teamed up for more Breeders' Cup success at Del Mar just a couple of weeks ago, was sold of an Angel in the filly mare sprint. What were your thoughts about her? She was a long shot going into that race. And tell us a little bit about the decision to back her up to one turn races, which turned out to be quite fortuitous.
Yeah, Randy, when we, you know, the whole reason I bought this filly, we went back and looked at her past performances. We dug pretty deep in there at the beginning of her career. She ran an absolute incredible race. It's kind of hidden in the form back. It was a one-turn mile at Gulfstream. And she beat a very nice horse of Pletcher's and Safi's. And Three Witches was in that race, actually, who came back and ran, I think, last year third in the Breeders' Cup. So it was a sneaky good race. She kind of exploded and basically did the same thing she did in the Breeders' Cup race. She ran an 8 on the rag sheets, which for a three-year-old filly that time of the year is a very good number. So she never got back to that until we bought her. And I told Safi when we bought her, you know, we have one turn is what we want to do. How short, we don't know, but let's take a shot in the ruffian. And that kind of proved our thought process there. She ran so good there was really no one-turn races coming up. So what we decided to do is stretch her out around two turns. She ran okay in the personal ensign. And then we ran her over at Monmouth against Idiomatic. Now, if you really dig deep in there, that was nothing more than a half-mile sprint to the wire. She went around there in 26, 27, believe it or not, the first quarter. She got down, and Irad made a heck of a decision. So he I think it was a half mile pole or somewhere around there. He wanted to hook up, and she sprinted from the half mile pole to Idiomatic to the wire, which was a heck of a race. But, you know, that kind of told us right there, you know, you could, it kind of fooled us. But if you actually go back and look at it, this filly has a half mile to a 5/8 mile kick. You can use it at any point you want. So that kind of confirmed to us that she was a one-turn horse because of what Idea did, and they hooked up at the half-mile pole. But, you know, going into the Breeders' Cup filly and mare sprint, we were very high on this filly. She wasn't 100% mentally right going into the Molly Pritchard. And, you know, she wasn't. She just was acting funny. She didn't break good. She had her head sideways out of the gate. If you go back and look at the head-on, she's actually not focused at all on running. And we were very concerned. I was in the paddock of the way she acted, because this filly here is just strictly professional. But going back to the Breeders' Cup filly and mare sprint, we were very high on her in this race. We thought the pace scenario was really going to help us. And, you know, the rest is history, I guess.
Well, hindsight is definitely 20/20. We should have had you on before the Breeders' Cup, to be perfectly honest. I was knocked out in the first leg in all my wagers because I didn't have her. So congratulations. But really, how gratifying was it for you and your brother, Drayden van Dyke, after what he's been through this year, Safi getting his first Breeders' Cup win, especially after what happened last year with Juan Barrio as well? Like, it's an amazing story when you really break it down.
It really is, you know, and then you factor in the name of the horse.
Yeah.
as well. You know, Drayden, he went through some tough times down there. You know, we thought for a minute about putting Irad back on the horse, and then we really dug deep and thought about it. Said, you know what, Drayden knows what he's doing. He's a good rider. Del Mar, he's had a lot of success at Del Mar. And, you know, he fits this, his riding style, in my opinion, fits this kind of horse. He's already had an outing on her. So, you know, we had all the confidence in the world Drayden was going to give us a good ride, and he did. So we're very happy with that. And then Safi, you know, there's nothing more rewarding than exactly what you said, what happened last year, to be able to come back and get his first Breeders' Cup win. You know, it's just a combination of things. It's just a great feeling.
Were you ever in doubt watching her go down the backside? Were you like, ooh?
Not really. Not really. I mean, maybe for the first 100 yards. And then I saw the first quarter come up. And it was a, you know, it was a pressured pace. And I started feeling, and then she started gradually picking it up, you know. And like I said, I think, Randy, she went 57 and changed the last 5/8. So, you know, she was flying at the end. She ended up getting a 3 3/4 rag number out of the race, which is her best number, one of the better rag numbers of the year of any horse that's run.
Mark, I want to take you back to White Iberio, and people are going to be curious. I know the story, but I think it needs to be told. Take us through the kind of the melodrama and the roller coaster of having Safi, losing Safi, going to Dutro, going back to Safi.
Yeah, you know, that whole situation with what Safi had to go through at Churchill with the two sudden deaths on the racetrack. I mean, you know, it's my feeling all along, and a lot of people I've talked to, you know, there was a lot of breakdowns. That I think there was 8 to 12, I believe, that week before the Derby. And Churchill, you know, they're looking out for their own best interest for their product and the Derby brand name and everything else. So I think they were kind of backed into a corner, one to do something from a marketing standpoint. And unfortunately, Safi was a scapegoat. You know, we had to scratch White Iberio out of the Churchill Downs handicap against Cody's Wish there. And, you know, that obviously leaves a very sour taste in your mouth. And then Safi had Pete Vetsko's horse got scratched out of the Kentucky Derby. You know, what was really upsetting was that the two horses that were involved in the deaths came from Keeneland. My horse was stabled at Belmont and shipped down, you know, basically the day before any of this stuff happened. They had accepted, they already knew this, you know, this had happened. They accepted our entries. They did all that. We shipped the horse. And, you know, I met personally, with the track, I met with the stewards, I met with the vets, I met with everybody. There was just nothing we could do about it. And, you know, that's when I had to make a decision. What's the next step here? Because we wanted to point for the Met Mile. And I had to make just a quick decision on that. We only had a few weeks to do that. And, you know, Rick at that point, Rick was coming off of what he went through. And I've had a long track history with Rick. Paul Pompa was a good friend of mine. I put a lot of horses with him in the barn, had a lot of success. And, you know, I thought it was the right move at the right time to give the horse to Rick. And it turned out it worked. So
what about the decision to go from Rick then back to Safi?
Yeah, that, you know, I just wasn't happy after the Met Mile performance. You know, I'm big on getting information. You know, I manage all my own horses for the stable for C2, my brother and I. And if you can't get accurate information, it puts us in a bind on managing the horse, whether it's running timing-wise, whether it's running in the right race, mapping out a campaign, selling the horse at the right time, whatever it is, you got to get accurate information. And, you know, I don't know if it was, you know, it's very small details that matter in this business. Everybody's, you know, if you can't get the small details right, then you're at a disadvantage. So one thing Safi and I built up is a relationship where I get very accurate information, and what he tells me turns out to be the case You know, when I buy a horse, I have expectations for a horse and what I think the horse can accomplish. And we have a very good dialogue and game plan on that. And, you know, when we're clicking on all cylinders like that, again, the information is the key.
So spinning this forward, Mark, if we assume that, and you can't assume anything in horse racing, but for the sake of this conversation, let's assume that Wyatt Abario pleases you in his return. What's on the agenda now, you think, for Soul of an Angel coming up in the immediate future? And then Wyatt Abario, if he were to run well and come out of the race well?
Yeah, he does have to run. And not only does he have to run well, he's got to run great. Okay, we got a lot of balls in the air right now. We got the Japanese looking at him to buy him as a stallion prospect. So that's one option. We've got, you know, a partner on the horse in Prince Faisal. So that's another option. The third option is running him, our preference, and the whole point we're here in this race is to run him one more year and then turn him over to the breeding shed. You know, with everything's going on and people pulling horses out of training and everything else, you know, this horse does have a fan base, especially in South Florida here. And, you know, we're in the racing side of this business. I've always been in the racing side. The breeding side really has never entered, you know, interest in us that much. So that's the whole point. He's in this race. Without all being said, he's going to have to run good. He's going to have to probably run 100 plus buyer. He's going to have to do it the right way. We're going to have confidence in A, that he's back 100% and that we can carry on. If I don't see that flash of brilliance here that he showed in the past, then he's probably going to, we're going to have to make a decision. I'll talk to Prince Faisal and he'll either go to Japan or he'll go to Prince Faisal and we'll do something with a stallion, you know, over here. So it's a very important race.
Has Soul of an Angel been retired?
Absolutely not. We're going to run her one more year. We're going to run her coming up on the 26th at Gulfstream, a one-turn mile in the Rampart for fillies. And that's going to be her prep race for the Saudi Cup, possibly. Whoa. We've got that on there. It's 50-50. I want to see how she runs here. I want to see who's going to the Saudi Cup. It's a one-turn race. You know, you trickle in for fourth or fifth, you're looking at a million and a half bucks. So, you know, it takes a lot of racing over here to win in $1.5 million in these races over here. But if we don't go that angle, then we're going to point for a one more year and try to defend our title in the British Cup Filly Mare Sprint.
Well, that's very cool. I hope Wyatt Abario wins by 15 and we get to see him next year. I mean, looking at the field, he should. I mean, that's
I need to. We got another one in there, but, you know, he's just a horse. But, you know, it's not about winning. Like I said, it's got to be done the right way. And then if that happens, then we're going to go on the Harlins holiday on the 21st. And assuming he runs good there, then we're going to probably look at the Pegasus here.
You're a man with a plan. How do you go about, before we came on, you put down the phone and you were like, oh, that's a horse I'm trying to buy. Although you won't tell me who you're trying to buy until the deal's done. So I expect a text later, by the way. but how do you go about purchasing these horses? You've mentioned the Ragason numbers a few times. Do you go by the numbers? Do you go by the visual performance? Do you go by, oh, off the trainer, maybe we can move this horse up? Like, what do you look for when you're trying to purchase these horses? Because you've had so much success.
Well, I look at all of the above, really. I mean, you got it. You know, I look at every chart, every equibase chart every day. I don't care if it's at Lone Star, Oaklawn. I don't care. A good horse can come from anywhere. So I start there. And then I look at the trainer. You know, there's only certain trainers I want to buy off of. You know, I'm not going to go over there to Brad Cox Barn and try to buy something off Brad. All right. So, and then over the last 25 years, I've learned there's certain owners that will sell and they won't sell. So I don't waste a lot of time trying to buy horses from owners that I know aren't going to sell. Then I'll look at the race. I'll look at the race replay. If I like that, then, you know, most of them get weeded out after that part. I'm a big pace guy. I like internal fractions. I think horses can do things sneaky good internally within the race. that it's hard for other people to see or hard to see visually. So I'll look at pace numbers, I look at buyer numbers, rag numbers, Thoroughgraph. I put it all together and try to make a package, you know, put all this in and package it up. But, you know, the main thing is when you're buying a horse, you've got to have a plan. We don't just buy horses just to buy a horse to run in a race. We usually have a 3 to 5 race plan mapped out when we buy these and try to execute a business model for that specific horse.
Mark, it appears that of all those things that you look at and go into it, I got to guess pedigree is not on the top of the list. White Iberio is by Race Day. That's not exactly Into Mischief. Soul of an Angel is by Atreides. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right. That's not exactly Gun Runner. So it appears that the pedigree is not a big part of the equation.
No, because they've already run.
Right.
All right. They've already run. So I need to see talent, you know. It's like Blind Luck when we bought her. She's by Pollard's Vision. All right. So, you know, I can't go out there and buy in the day a Stormcat or a deputy minister or something of that nature. It's not going to happen. So they still got to be under the radar. They got to show talent. Right. And they're probably lacking on pedigree. You know, the one thing that we do pride ourselves on when you go over there, you want them to at least be physically look the part. Okay. Most of the time when we buy something, they're missing something. They're missing something, whether it's the pedigree or something, or a speed figure or something. But if they got the whole package where they went out there one by 15 lengths, right, and they're by Gun Runner and all this, you're not going to be able to buy the horse. And if you were, it's going to be 4 or 5 million. That's what we want to sell, not buy.
So, Mark, if I'm not mistaken, you're a Dallas area guy, right? Flower Mound, Texas?
Correct.
Correct. Okay. I have a son that graduated from Flower Mound High School.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Anyway, I lived in Coppell at one point. I lived in Valley Ranch at one point, worked for the Fort Worth newspaper, the Dallas Morning News. You know, I was right there at the beginning of re-emergence of Texas racing after so many years in the mid to late 1990s. What's the status right now, in your opinion, with horse racing in Texas, which had so much promise when it got going at Lone Star, especially, but also Houston Rotama way back in the day? Now, what are you looking at as far as Texas racing?
Well, you know, I haven't been involved in it, Randy, in a while, but I was on the board of directors for the Texas Thoroughbred Breeders Association with John Adger and Bill Heiligbrod, and I were on there. And Steve's dad, Keith, we were all on there. And, you know, for years, we always banged our head against the wall trying to get the slots. And around every turn, it was either the lobbyists for the casinos in the other states or the Southern Baptists, somebody trying to kill getting slots in at the racetrack. You know, you go to these other tracks, Louisiana Downs, Remington Park, it's all Texas license plates in the parking lot. So, you know, I hear that they're working on things, but I'm not in that loop anymore. You know, if they do, you know, we ran budgets and projections and everything of that nature. And the purse structure, if they were ever to get them, would be like Churchill, you know, $140,000 maiden races and allowance races. That was the projection. And that was 10 to 15 years ago. So hopefully it occurs. We need to add something in race wise. We need to add another state for sure to get this thing going, especially the way California is trending.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for your time. Best of luck with White Iberio on Friday. Let's hope that he lives up to your expectations and we can see him have a great 2025. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Cheers, Mark.
TD and Riders Room also brought to you by the PHBA, the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association. This past week, the Claiming Crown Stakes races, and we had an open company, Pennsylvania Bred Double. First of all, Like a Salt Shaker won the $136,000 Rapid Transit Stakes. Yes, Like a Salt Shaker is a Pennsylvania bred by Glenn Brock, LLC, owned by the Marisco Brothers Racing. Then you had Concrete Glory, who won a Claiming Crown Stakes called the $100,000 Reddy's Rocket Express, owned by Big Frank Stable, bred by the Bodemeister Syndicate and Kyle Horlocker. To learn more about that Pennsylvania Bread program, you can have your own success. Go to pabread.com or call this number, 610-444-1050.
PA Bread, I think we've built a brand at this point.
It's excitement at every step.
Roses for Deborah just set a new track record.
On average, for the past decade, Pennsylvania paid over $28 million a year in breeders' awards, restricted races, and owner bonuses. Plus, PA Bred shine on the world's biggest stage. Just three states have bred more Breeders' Cup winners. Learn more at PABred.com.
With some of the fullest fields in the country and quality racing year-round, there's never been a better time to reap the rewards of breeding and racing in Kentucky. Purse money in Kentucky is at an all-time high, as is average purse per race, outpacing California, Florida, and New York. Kentucky Breds. Breed them. Raise them. Race them. We all win.
We are also sponsored here at the TD and Writers Room by Kentucky Breds. Isn't that apropos, as many races as they win? With seven wins, seven at this year's Breeders' Cup World Championships, including Sierra Leone's win in the Breeders' Cup Classic, Kentucky Breds now have won 256 Breeders' Cup races, more than any other state or country, even Ireland, including 29 wins alone in the Breeders' Cup Classic. Kentucky Breds, meanwhile, have also shined in Europe in 2024. This week, the Cartier Awards are almost certainly going to crown City of Troy as the European champion three-year-old Kentucky Bred. You have Rama Tuel and Opera Singer winning important races, Kentucky Breds. You have Group 2 winning two-year-olds, Shareholder and Black Forza, Kentucky Breds. And here's one that sort of flew under the radar this year. When's the last time you heard anyone talking about Laurel River, who turned in perhaps one of the best performances of any horse in the calendar year 2024, romping in the Dubai World Cup? Laurel River, a Kentucky Bred. Of course, Kentucky Breds. Breed them, buy them, raise them. We all win.
Friday at Del Mar, the big news on the card was the reemergence of Tamara, that's the right pronunciation, I believe, who is the beautifully bred daughter of Beholder, the great, great mare. She was all the rage last year. She won the Del Mar Debutante. She looked great. Everybody was thinking this is going to be the next superstar. She gets hurt in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies, and we don't see her for a year. She comes back on Friday and loses by a nose to Michael McCarthy. Zoe pointed out how hot he's been. I got kind of a wishy-washy feeling about this. I believe that Randy and Zoe are going to have some fun with this. So why don't you guys take it away?
Go ahead, Zoe.
Okay. Sandy Button wins the race. And it's kind of ironic that Sandy Button's by Omaha Beach, who, of course, Dick Mandela trained. Basically, Tamara lost the race from the rail, and she got beat a nose. She didn't get off to a great start. She kind of got sent up there under Mike Smith. She looked like a winner coming down the lane. She just couldn't get by Sandy Button. It was a nose that separated them. I'm not sure she lost anything in defeat, and I'm also not sure that people are giving credit to Sandy Button. She's undefeated, right, in three starts?
Yes.
Three for three.
She's undefeated in three starts. I'm not sure that people are thinking that she's that good a filly. She is now. She's beaten Tamara. So we'll see where Tamara shows up next. But I don't think it was a massive knock losing. I believe it was the rail that beat her.
They didn't run all that fast. I think the buyer was an 83 or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, Tamara got all this publicity as a two-year-old filly primarily because she was out of Beholder. And yeah, she looked good, but she never did run all that fast. And then she was beaten, and then she laid off, and now she comes back and she's beaten again. The hope was that she was never going to be obviously as good as Beholder, but the hope was that she was going to be like, you know, this real superstar in the sport. Right now, Tamara hasn't shown me anything that would indicate that she's going to be a future superstar. When I looked at the race, I thought, okay, she lost by a nose. That's not bad. She hadn't run in 377 days. I mean, what a comeback race. Sandy Bottom hadn't run in 390 days. She had a longer way off than Tamara did. And yet Sandy Bottom was able to outgain Tamara during the last part of the race. Yeah, I mean, the rail didn't help Tamara. She didn't get off all that fast, but I mean, that's part of it, you know?
Randy, I'm sort of on the same side as you. You know, was it a terrible race? No, but we're not talking about just an ordinary horse or someone that's a nice stakes horse. This horse, the hype machine was going wild. I fell for it too. I loved her after their Del Mar debutante win. She's out of Beholder, like can't be better than that. I know she only lost by a nose. I know she hadn't run in a year, but if she's Tamara, if she's that superstar we're looking for, she does not lose that race. I'm sorry. No. Maybe she doesn't win it by 10 lengths, but she does not lose. Can she bounce back in her next start for Dick Mandela? Absolutely, she could. But Randy, I would side with you here right now. I want to see her do something more.
And that next start, she'll get to run against Sandy Bottom again, if goes well, as well as some other good ones in the La Brea at Santa Anita on the day after Christmas at 7 furlongs. So that'll be a race we can really look forward to.
That's turning out to be a really, really good race. That could be, it's a really good race. So hold off to your ballots. Hold on to your ballots. People always put their ballots in for the Eclipse Awards before that day. And it's a very important day in racing.
Now, Randy, we want to know, and this is Zoe and I are showing concern. We like you. You're a friend of ours. How you doing? How you holding up on with this news this week that Senior Buscador is going to be retired after running in the Cigar Mile and then in the Pegasus? Randy, you going to be okay?
I think so. I think I'll be all right. Look, yeah, I'd love to see him running it. But the Peacocks aren't going to like this, but he ran his race in the Breeders' Cup Classic. He really did. It was a really tough Breeders' Cup Classic. It was a much stronger race top to bottom than the Saudi Cup or the Dubai World Cup, in my opinion. I have loved Senor Buscador and all he was able to accomplish. He came back in the Breeders' Cup Classic, bounced back from a really poor performance in his most recent start, his final prep. Ran what I thought was a very creditable race, ran his race. Just wasn't quite good enough. So they're going to send him off to stud right now, Zoe. We don't know where, though, right?
We don't. I think they have a plan in the works. I was at the November sale and I helped Moret Farrell. And I think it all stems through Shoham Place, where they board Eight Roses or whatever, the dam of Senor Buscador. So between Shoham and Courtney, who runs the farm over there, they got a hold of Moret Farrell and they set up a little, not a syndicate, but Senor Buscador mares. Moret bought about 8 mares for Senor Buscador to go to the breeding shed with, and they've been trying to buy some mares to support their stallion, as they should. So I got a chance to meet Joey and his wife there. It was their first time at the sale. It was actually really, really cool to see them. And hopefully they get some good mares to him. But plans are still up in the air of where he's actually going to go.
He's by Mineshaft. He's not a tremendously, commercially, sexy stallion. He's out of the Mare Roses Desert, who's a tremendous racehorse. He's been a tremendous producer. And Mr. Prospector in Spanish, Senor Buscador, retires with earnings just under $13 million. Job well done.
Now, wait a minute, Randy. You're going to get to see him run 2 more times, the Cigar Mile and then the Pegasus World Cup, then off to stud. So you don't have to, hit the bottle tonight or, cry yourself to sleep, at least for a couple months.
Buscador. All right. 2 more times. I'm ready.
All right.
Merry Christmas from the Peacocks.
This is our News You Can Use segment brought to you by Darley with European editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, Emma Berry. Emma, good morning. Good afternoon, I guess, in England. How are you today?
Very well, thanks. A little chilly here. There's snow all over the place. But it's good to see you all again.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Keeneland November sale, the Fasig Tipton November sale are in the books. The European foal and breeding stock sales are now up and running. There's always plenty of interest in the first foals of the new stallions. Who should we be looking for over there?
Well, we've got quite a punchy bunch this year. The sales have started this week in Ireland, and my colleague Brian Sheeran's slaving away on his birthday while I'm hiding away in Newmarket waiting for tattersalls to begin next week. But we've got I mean, probably the headline horse would be Baeed, who was Shadwell's great miler of a few years ago. It's hard to believe he's already got foals on the ground, because it seems a minute ago he was racing, but he was a brilliant horse by See the Stars. But there's a whole bunch of horses to look out for. I mean, Mermas has been one of the real sort of runaway stallions here over the last few years. He was leading first season sire. He had a Breeders' Cup winner a week or so ago in Magnum Force, and he's already got sort of a growing number of sons at stud, and we've got Persian Force and Minzal, both with first foals this year. And then there's a couple of young stallions from Dali as well. Perfect Power, who was a Royal Ascot winner, as was Naval Crown, both Group 1 winners for Dali, both quite pretty fast horses, both sprinters. They've already had foals sold this week in Ireland, and they both seem to be starting off well. So there's, as ever, so many to keep tabs on.
I'm going to ask you about two, Emma, because they're really intriguing to me. First off, we're going to go from one end of the spectrum to the other. What about Blackbeard? Because he was just brilliant as a two-year-old. And then the other spectrum, one of my favorite horses of all time, Stradivarius. What can you tell me about the pair of them?
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, both with their first foals. I haven't actually seen any Blackbeard foals yet, but they are already in the sale ring at Goff's. They'll probably have a bigger bunch there, but there'll be a handful as well over in Newmarket next week. I would expect them to be pretty commercial, because pin hooking is obviously such a big part of the foal sales, and the pin hookers on the whole tend to go for that sort of faster, sort of more precocious type of horse. Stradivarius, as you mentioned, is a really interesting entry, if you like, in this year's sort of flat sires, because so many of the really good stayers here do end up going straight to National Hunt Stars to be jump stallions. And Bjorn Nielsen, who was Stradivarius's owner breeder, was adamant that he wanted him to stand at a flat stud. So he negotiated for him to stand at the National Stud here in Newmarket. He's covered three-figure books in his first two seasons, which is great. I mean, there have been a few jumping mares among those, but a lot of flat mares too. And there are 14 foals selling next week at Tassels. So I'm looking forward to seeing those. I actually have one myself as well who's not for sale, but he is a real favourite. And it's going to be very interesting to see how he gets on as a flat stallion. There is actually Brian Sheeran made a comment in today's TDN Europe that, it would be nice to see a bit more variety among the offspring, among these foals for sale across the distance spectrum. And that's what we will get with Stradivarius. He was at absolutely the opposite ends, but he had a real potent turn of foot for a stayer. And I won't be surprised at all if he gets some good flat runners. They'll probably be coming more into their own as three-year-olds, but he actually won it too himself. And it's a really interesting horse. He's by See the Stars as well, who's a top-class sire. So, we'll be watching him with great interest, you and me both, I think, Zoe.
Didn't he be bred to the Dam of Economics? That's huge, isn't it?
Yep, La Pont de Mort, lovely Panche Celebre mare of Copgrove All-Stud. She's in foal to him at the moment, which is a real thing in the cap of the National Stud to get that mare. And Bjorn Nielsen has supported him very well. There's some nice flat mares that we've got. And it's actually interesting looking through the return of mares and seeing some of the breeders who've used him. There's some. They also introduced a bonus scheme for him. So the first 10 juvenile winners, their breeders get a sort of, I think it's £25,000 bonus. And if you breed a Group 1 winner by him from his first two crops, there's a £250,000 bonus. So there were some incentives to use him, certainly.
So, Emma, you said you could look outside and see snow, which, of course, means that the European turf season is over. But there are some opportunities elsewhere, Hong Kong, later Dubai. This Sunday, the Japan Cup, mile and a half on turf, 10 trillion yen or whatever the purse is for that thing nowadays. The locals are obviously always really tough to beat in the Japan Cup, but there's some pretty strong European representation this year. Tell us about some of those horses and what you think the chances are that the Euros can take down the Japanese in their own backyard.
It's going to be a fascinating race. I was just chatting to Alan Carasso, actually, who's going to be getting up at something, or probably staying up, actually. I think it's about 1:40 a.m. On the East Coast of America. It's in the morning for us. But I can't wait to see how August Rodin goes. I mean, he's been one of my favorite horses for the last few seasons. And he's off to start straight away after this. The Japanese, although he's obviously, you know, Irish trained and been running in Europe, the Japanese feel it's a bit of a homecoming for him because he's by Deep Impact. So I think they're getting very excited about him being there. He's not the only European runner. Goliath, who won the King George, has gone over. He's now owned by John Stewart, Resolute Racing, or majority owned by John, I should say, still trained in France by Francis Graffard. And then also that we have a German runner, last year's German Derby winner, Fantastic Moon. So it's very exciting from our perspective here in Europe to see how all three of those get on. But as ever, the home team, I mean, I heard Naoya Hirigoda talking this morning on the Nick Luck podcast, saying that he felt the Japanese home defense, if you like, was a bit weaker this year. I mean, last year was Japan Cup was the top rated race in the world. And, you know, Equinox won, obviously. And I think the first five home were all Japanese classic winners. That's the strength they have in that race. But even though Naohiro seemed to think this year was a little bit weaker, I was looking through the field. And there's still, I think, at least four Japanese classic winners in there. So it's not going to be a slam dunk for any of the sort of visiting horses, but it'll be a great race. I'll certainly be getting up very early on Sunday morning to make sure I see it.
The Tenno Show is always a key race there for the Japan Cup, by the way.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And Dojuice, the winner of that, is running, and he's the Japanese Derby winner of a couple of years ago as well. So, you know, there's some proper, you know, just proper horses, as you expect. I mean, it's a brilliant race, and it's always a strong field. But it'll be fantastic to see August Rodin running again and hopefully going out with a big, you know, big shout before he's off to start in Ireland.
Well, we want to thank Emma Berry for the segment. The News You Can Use is brought to you by Darley. Emma, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for putting up some good information for us.
It's a pleasure.
Two of Darley's young stallions, Perfect Power and Naval Crown, each have their first foals on sale over the next few weeks in Ireland and Britain. A brilliant two-year-old and a dual Royal Ascot winner, Perfect Power carried his juvenile form through his three-year-old season, adding the Commonwealth Cup to his Group 1 triumphs in the Pre-Morney and Middle Park Stakes. Naval Crown was also a Group 1 winner at Royal Ascot, one of the fastest sons of Dubawi. He won the Platinum Jubilee over 6 furlongs. That's probably one of the best races at Royal Ascot.
Be a smarter better with XBEED TV. The best horses. With thousands of exclusive morning workouts. All at your fingertips and delivered right into your inbox. Everything you need to be informed. Be smart. Bet smart with XBTV.
The TDM Writers' Room is brought to you by XBEED TV, and this week's Work of the Week is Wida Barrio, who worked 3 furlongs in 35.06. He worked in company with Silver Moonlight, who was caught in 35.63. Wida Barrio, as we talked about earlier, is scheduled to return to action next Friday at Goldstream Park in a 7-furlong allowance race, his first start since returning to trainer Safi Joseph Barn. I'm thinking he can win by 15. Just look how good he looks right here.
Well, we've been talking a lot about Safi Joseph on this podcast, and let's bring him up again. He did something that I wonder has ever been done before, and this is giving the TDN a pat on the back, but a well-deserved one, the coveted Rising Star moniker that they give to horses who are very impressive first or second time out. Safi didn't just have one, he had two. On Friday, he ran a filly by the name of Rojo Rita. She won by 16 and a quarter lengths, comes back the next day and runs a colt by the name of Grayscale, went off at 1-5, Drayden Van Dyke aboard. That's a big part of this story, by the way. That horse wins easily as well, not quite as easily as Rojo Rita. Randy, I want to start with you though first. The filly that wins by 16 and a quarter gets an 83 buyer. Mm-hmm. Is that a particularly difficult race to attach a number to?
No.
When someone wins? No. And tell me why not?
It's all about the time relative to how fast the racetrack surface was. It has nothing to do with margin of victory or anything like that. And which it's not always the case at Gulfstream Park. that it's easy to come up with a track variant and determine how fast the track is, because there are now three different racing surfaces at Gulfstream and it's all divided up and you don't get sample sizes that are very big. In this case on Friday, it was pretty straightforward. So I think the 83 is a pretty confident number. If you look at the horses behind her, they're all like in the 40s. I mean, she had very little competition in there. I think that was the main reason for the margin of victory being what it was. And then Grayscale, I mean, she's a son of, she's a daughter of Volatile. Wasn't all that expensive. I think 80 grand or something like that. Grayscale's a son of Frosted. He got an 86 buyer speed figure. Solid, very solid for a 2-year-old debut. So he's one, you know, owned by the E5 Racing Thoroughbreds. He's one that we can watch as now, you know, some of the top horses in New York migrate down to Florida, and we'll see how Grayscale stacks up against some of the others. Safi's got some other ones too that are, I think his best 2-year-old is a horse called Neo Equos, who finished second behind the 2-year-old that's all the rage in Florida right now, rated by merit. He's finished second to him a couple of times. And he got a 91 buyer most recently when he was second to rated by merit. When rated by merit, got a 99. So Safi's pretty loaded. This edition of TD and Riders are brought to you by Safi Joseph and Michael McCarthy. Zoe?
Yeah, absolutely. Grayscale was good. He tipped his hand in a work the week before, going in 44-4. Yeah. Under Drayden Van Dyke. Now, I went back and watched the work because you have to watch it to believe it. And this is where sometimes you need walkie-talkies. You'd be like, hey, boys, just what the hell are you doing out there? Slow the hell down. They did kind of nudge the two horses to the wire, but he looked good doing it. He did it the right way. And while Grayscale is good, his company in that sparkling 44-4 work was a horse called Thought Control. He's a son of Gunrunner, and he might be just as good as him, if not better. Safi's loaded. Yeah, let's drink to that. When are we going to play our drinking game show? Next week? We might have to do it a bit later, because even by my standards, 9 a.m. Pacific time is just a little bit too early. We can do it next week, right?
Right, we'll keep that in mind, Zoe.
Christmas show.
Well, speaking of popular horses that have won of late or have been in the news, who doesn't like No Balls? I mean, yeah, a name like that. How do you not like that horse? But he was in a little bit of a funk. Three starts this year after winning the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint. 0-3, had not hit the board. He went up to Canada to take on one of my favorite horses, Patches O'Houlihan, Canadian star, who was 11-13 lifetime, was huge favorite. And No Balls is back. He beat him. And according to the TDN, looks like he's going to go to Hong Kong next time out to run in one of those rich races there. But he didn't even go in the Breeders' Cup this year. I'm sure trainer Larry Rivelli just didn't think he merited a start in there with the kind of year he's having. But he beat, not only did he win, he beat a very, very good horse. So maybe he's back, Zoe.
Maybe he is. Well, we know one thing. E.T. Baird has his passport now. Apparently it took him 12 hours to get his passport. I have to look it up because when I first started riding, I rode with ET and he was already a veteran rider there. Now, I didn't start when I was 16. I was 25 when I won my first race. So I looked it up. I'm like, how old is ET Baird? Like, he's been around forever. 57 years young by my calculation.
Wow.
ET, so still winning races. I think he's had a prolonged career because he never used to come out in the mornings. If you know ET, he's like, why would I come in the mornings and work 10 horses? I'm saving my energy for the afternoon. Mm-hmm. You rarely saw him on a horse in the morning back in the Arlington Park days. So ET Baird, No Balls, kick on. Let's see where they wind up.
The TD and Riders Room, also brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. We talk every week about, you know, all the horses that West Point, the stakes horses that they own and how well they're doing, and they're winning races in Kentucky and New York. Well, how about California? We've already talked about the Bob Hope Stakes, right, for two-year-olds. Bullard, trained by Michael McCarthy, coming from off the pace, coming from last, roaring by the field, winning by almost five lengths. Well, guess what? Bullard is co-owned by West Point Thoroughbreds. They race the Gunrunner Colt in a group that includes St. Elias Stable of Vinnie Viola, Three Chimneys Farm, and Michael Talla. To learn more about West Point and how you can get involved, the website www.westpointtb.com.
All the thrills, fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
That is a wrap on this week's show. I want to thank my partner Zoe Kamen and Randy Moss. I want to thank Mark Cornett, our guest of the week, and also the people that work behind the scenes and do such a great job, our producers, Katie Petruniak, Anthony LaRocca, and Alita LaRocca. Everybody have a great racing week. We'll see you next week.